Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
You're about to listen to a new episode of the Redefining Cybersecurity Podcast with Sean Martin. Have you ever thought we're selling cybersecurity insincerely, buying it indiscriminately, and deploying it ineffectively? Well, perhaps we are. Let's look at how we can organize a successful information security program that integrates business culture with people, process, and technology to drive growth and protect business value.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
Welcome to the ITSP Magazine Podcast Network. You're listening to a new Redefining Cybersecurity podcast with Sean Martin. Have you ever thought that we're selling cybersecurity insincerely, buying it indiscriminately, and deploying it ineffectively? Well, perhaps we are. Let's look at how we can organize a successful information security program that integrates business culture with people, process, and technology to drive growth and protect business value. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com. Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com.
Everybody, you're very welcome to a new episode of Redefining Cybersecurity Podcast here on the ITSP Magazine Podcast Network. This is Sean Martin, your host, where I get to talk about all cool things cyber-related, ultimately to help the business protect the revenue it generates and hopefully even get in a position where we can help securely generate more revenue. And I think with most organizations, I think, what's the term? Most organizations are tech companies now because they're all building their own software. Today's topic is super important, and we're going to be looking at software supply chain, and I'm thrilled to have Cassie Crossley on. Cassie, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
It's going to be a fun chat, and as with many things on my show, it's rooted in a post that I saw. And this post, my response, I believe, was congratulations on getting your book published. There was a lot of comments in the chat about that, or in the thread about that. Software Supply Chain Security, it's the first edition written by you, Cassie. Congratulations on that. We're going to talk about a bit about the book and what it means to have a software supply chain security in the business and beyond. So before we get to that, though, a few words about you, what you've been up to, what you have going on right now. Be great.
Sure. Well, I work at Schneider Electric. I am the vice president for supply chain security. So it's more than just software. It's the hardware also, and have been part of the cybersecurity and product security office for, I believe, about 8 years now, but I've been with the company for 14. My background is in software development. where I was long ago a developer, but moved more into engineering management, project management, program management, both on the R&D and product development side, but also on the IT. So I go back and forth depending on what's more challenging at the time. And when I was working in the cybersecurity office, specifically working with a lot of our suppliers, I was very aware, of course, the risk that suppliers can bring into organizations and have, you know, in the past led disaster recovery processes and all sorts of different areas of, you know, let's just say security and resilience. And then when I moved into the product security office, I was very eager to work on increasing the posture of products. And we have a very large portfolio. Schneider Electric is a 36 billion euro company headquartered in France. And we have a large number of SKUs, let's say hundreds of thousands of SKUs. But if you look at the intelligent products, software, hardware, OT products, that level is OT for operational technology, and of course, IT and other kinds of products. Our 15,000 SKUs, that's a lot of products. We have over 12,000 people in R&D. So a large group to concern with the product security and application security. And part of that, again, is the supply chain of which Schneider Electric is part of, but also the suppliers who work with us. And I had developed a process not just to do assessments of our suppliers that provide software or intelligent hardware components for our products, even the manufacturing organizations that touch our products as it goes through the life cycle, and having an assessment, but also evidence-based assessment process. I realized that the suppliers out there with, you know, not intending to, but their product security posture was not as much as we had hoped. And we also acquire companies. And, you know, when you're looking at a large organization like Schneider Electric, where we have an established office and we follow the IEC 62443-4-1 secure development lifecycle standard at the highest level of maturity. So I spent a lot of time working with suppliers and also our ecosystem subsidiaries that what do they need to do in stair-step fashion to increase the security posture of the products, but also how do we mitigate that risk in the meantime? So that could mean things like we perform penetration tests because they may not have been performed on those products. And we do in-depth analysis and talk about secure coding, the same kind of things as if they were our own developers, because we have to think of them as that, right? You know, we're, you know, when we're reselling or repackaging or putting something with our name on it, that puts the warranty and the responsibility as much on us as it does on who supplied that to us. Those two, you know, second tier, fourth party, fifth party suppliers. And so that was a very important part of the process and the learnings that I did, especially working with like 2,000 intelligent, you know, suppliers that they're all at these various levels. And so I'm heavily in the application security community at the leadership level. I was part of a community that launched during COVID called the Purple Book Community. We wrote a digital book about application security. And they asked me to do the process chapter because I have a very, you know, extensive process background. And I went to them and I said, I really want to write this chapter called Software Supply Chain Security. And they're like, well, you know, what is that? Would tell us more about it. And this was pre-SolarWinds. But having been a developer, I knew all the risks. This was pre-Google Salsa or any of the other kinds of things. But understanding the risk, you know, of knowing who had access to the source code, how it was put through build processes, all of that, it was really important to me from the beginning, both setting that structure. So I wrote the chapter and before we even released, SolarWinds came out. So of course I had an update and their ghost editor that they had, I told him, oh yeah, there's enough for a full book. And he said, you should write it. And I'm like, oh, I don't have time to write a book. I've got a very large and very busy life. And he's like, no, you really should write it because no one's written anything on this. And so he introduced me to O'Reilly Media and I gave them the book proposal and wrote the book. It took about a year and a half, and things are changing all the time. So I already have an errata sheet. And, you know, I told them, I said, this is going to need a new edition every 2 years because it is rapidly changing. I was writing things that are still in draft form when I was writing about the software attestation form by CISA, all of that. You know, those things haven't been solidified, but yet we're having to update everything every day. So that's how it came about.
It's fascinating. And yeah, because I was wondering, with the big picture view of hardware and suppliers of components and software that makes all that stuff work, why you would focus in on software specifically. So clearly it was because you wanted to write that chapter, but is there something more to it than?
Yes. Than that? Yeah. Well, first off, when I first started it, I didn't have the role of just supply chain security, but the subtitle of the book is Securing the End-to-End Supply Chain for Software, Hardware, Firmware, and Hardware. Because, you know, let's just say you're using Intel chips. Well, you know, there's libraries, there's things involved with those intelligent components, semiconductors, anything that has these libraries and other areas from a supply chain. So, you know, it could have just said supply chain security because I actually did include all of it in there. But software supply chain security, it's a big topic all around the world right now. So the book is for both audiences. You really can't talk about hardware supply chain security without talking about just cybersecurity in general. There's a whole chapter on infrastructure security for development environments, for test labs. You know, a lot of companies, they have IoT test labs if they're building IoT products. And how are they securing that, you know, to make sure that it doesn't get in and affect their normal corporate systems? And that's what I, you know, could see is that folks, they would understand IT security, but they stayed hands off to development environments. They didn't understand how developers would do the work because they didn't want to restrict them. But there's also the risk that developers, we have the ability to download plugins, to build our own code, to take whatever we need just on those environments that we're building. And any of that could be a path for an attacker into the actual code base itself at some point in time. I mean, if somebody had a keylogger, boom, you know, if they didn't have MFA and they're still, you know, there are still environments, it's not, you know, until the most recent years that GitHub has, you know, done more to force MFA and other areas where people are, let's just say, being more careful about the source code that they're keeping proprietary. And so it is, all goes hand in hand. There's a specific chapter, I put it near the end of the book, because in case people don't have this environment, but it's about the manufacturing environment. Because I wrote this book not only for the people who are building things themselves, but anyone who's buying something. There's no CISO out there that hasn't bought an IoT product, right? You know, of course they buy software and, you know, SaaS and, you know, all of that, but they're also buying printers and laptops and things like that. And you really have to understand and ask your suppliers, what are you doing in your manufacturing environments to ensure integrity of the entire process? And, you know, that's why I wanted to cover holistically throughout the book.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's easy to forget about the, well, having a software background, I understand the build process, right? There's a little check-in and somebody actually builds it and releases it and goes to QA and all that stuff. But probably a different animal when you start talking about hardware. And it in my head, and I can't stop thinking about it, is software on the device. So embedded, yes. embedded stuff. I presume you talk about that as well.
Yes.
It's a different animal, right?
Right. Yeah. And I use the word firmware and I explain the difference between embedded software and firmware, but just generically, it's all very important. And I explain the difficulty with when you're creating and working with embedded software and firmware is unlike, let's just say, an environment that you may use every day, Outlook or anything that you're accessing over the web. You know, those kinds of components can be generally swapped out very quickly. But when you are tied to hardware architecture, even when it's got some extensible or more of an open architecture so that it's out there, if you are working with products that are safety related, such as medical devices or the products in many of our world, which is the critical infrastructure, that making sure that just upgrading that library doesn't cause any kind of failure is extremely important. So it's a very careful process that you have to do when you've got embedded software and firmware in your devices to make sure that it doesn't affect, even just, let's just say, if there's latency added by changing out the library, that can impact safety. So there's rigid testing that has to go through. So I think that those that come from a straight software world, especially those that are working on container-based systems these days or anything else, it's like, I'll just swap it out. It's a new service. And that risk is always present when you're working with the firmware. And I think that we saw a little bit of that with some of the other attacks like Heartbleed and some of the other ones where, just one change and update to a chip caused people's devices to brick. It was like, they were useless. And all of a sudden everybody's like, don't patch. We've got to fix this other thing. Because when you're rushing to do that, things like that can happen, and we can't afford that to happen in certain situations.
So I'm going to combine this next part together. It's the two, who and what do you hope they get from it? Because I can see you mentioned a few already. There's people manufacturing parts that get used in assembling of bigger things. And then there's the embedded, the firmware, there's the software. There are people that use those things to, and then add their own software components to build out business processes. And then there are people buying those completed things. Do you touch all of those and others?
Yes.
When you're writing the book? And if so, how do you reach all of those people? An app developer is different than a hardware manufacturer, right? And so how do you reach all those different people? What is there an individual goal for each of them, or do you have a general goal for the book?
I didn't do individual goals. And I would say that if somebody was already an application security expert, this is a book that they would hand to other people because it's not, it's technical in the stance. It'll talk about cryptography and what it means and why it's important, but it doesn't, and it'll talk about, let's say, for hardware trusted platform modules. And that's so that somebody who wants to understand, why would this add to security? That gives them enough basis. There's over 200 references in the book so that they can go read more. So I'm not trying to become an application security technical expert for somebody reading this. I truly wrote it so that anybody in procurement and in legal, because I work every day with procurement and legal folks, and they do not have a cyber background. And cyber is the scary word still out there. If it says cyber, bring in the cyber expert and let's just let them handle it. But cyber folks are not legal experts. And they, there's so much that working together as a team. So the book is written, it does have a set of controls through there. So 78 controls in general, and it'll talk about what are the key important pieces for that area. So for example, in the development environment, it'll be like, make sure that you do asset management of the developer tools in addition to your normal IT processes, and that includes software. And so that's written more for the IT security folks. But I have an entire supplier chapter that it talks about, assessments and how to understand suppliers and what you should focus on. And that those controls in that supplier chapter are more geared toward procurement and legal folks to say, make sure you have in your contracts this kind of information. So it's really meant to be a practical guide that you can pick up and go back to or provide. I have a lot of people I know that are buying it for their sales and marketing organizations if they're in a cyber company. It's like, oh, you just started working at a software supply chain company. Now you need to understand the different risks. So I really did my best to write it as an expert. And I really think O'Reilly to help do this is the development editor didn't have a software supply chain background. That editor had worked on other technical books, but when I first started writing it, I was making leaps of where they probably understand this, but you know, I realized based off the comments and over time, you know, to even go a little bit more into why this is. And what I have in there a lot is explaining the risks and why this is important, because there's no sense in reading something just because, oh, I want to learn how to do it. But everything is based off of here's a risk and here's examples, especially a section on data protection and intellectual property. It's pretty, you know, for some people, it's an exciting topic, but for other people, it's a bit of a dull topic. And I really wanted to show examples to say, you know, this is where the passwords and keys, and this is the impact to the business it had. You know, this meant millions of dollars to this company. And, you know, here's all the areas. So I really tried to bring it home so that somebody could learn something as they're going through and not just be sitting there reading a technical document that's trying to prove, oh, I know all this stuff. It's really to give them the backbone so that they can continue learning, because in this world, especially is what we've got, this is becoming more and more important. And as I mentioned, I work with procurement folks all the time, not just from my company, but also from other companies, and they're eager to understand more about this. You know, they really want to know, you know, more than just, I know IT security, I can learn what a SIM is, but why is this important to have? And I think that sometimes in what we're educating and teaching, we assume somebody already has a basis going into it. And I didn't want to do that in this book.
Yeah, and it's interesting because granted, I've been talking third-party stuff the past few episodes that not many of them have been produced yet. But anyway, third-party risk and procurement keeps coming up, obviously.
Yeah.
It's an obvious one, but you don't think about them too much, sadly.
Right.
And they have a hard job when you mentioned the SIM, right? How does a procurement team verify the supply chain for a SIM, which, as you know, has a bunch of connectors and plugins and threat intelligence feeds, and the list goes on and on and on. Just that one thing. And then you go to the hardware side where you guys are delivering cool things for critical infrastructure, a lot of downstream stuff there too. How do you hope procurement, is it procurement's role then, do you think? Maybe put it this way, to kind of be the hub for that? Because we all know engineers go off and buy that new or lease or subscribe to a new service that gives them an API that lets them do credit card transactions or whatever it is, right? Outside of procurement's purview.
Sure.
So how does procurement play a role in kind of getting a view of all this stuff, or is there somebody else that really owns that and procurement's just their right-hand person?
That's a really good question, because I think that, as I mentioned, if the word cyber comes up, they immediately go to, where's the security person in the room? And for, you know, when a financial question comes up, they don't automatically go, where's the CFO in the room? And I think that it'll take a long time before in business classes and just normal programs where people are starting to understand technology, that in the future, maybe 20 years from now, everybody will have a baseline enough of cyber, and we're not there yet. And so I do think that this is more of a partnership. I think that the purpose for one, is for them not to ignore the subject, to have that familiarity to know when they're evaluating, or let's just say that somebody else didn't pick something, that they're told, you know, here, I want you to assess these three suppliers, that one of the first things that they would know to do in the future is, have any of these undergone a significant cyber attack? Do they have a lot of vulnerabilities in their products? It doesn't take a cybersecurity expert. If they really understand why that's important and what it is, then just going out, let's say supplier one, two, or three, that they can evaluate some of the cyber risk. Like, you know, if somebody had, let's just say, all of their source code compromised, and they may have a cyber score on one of their risk rating systems, you know, really bad, and a really low score, that they would be able to say, without somebody else telling them, this is a cyber risk, probably not a good choice, I'm going to take it off. And they do that already when they're looking at, let's just say, Dun & Bradstreet financial scores and things like that. And so we want to see that sometime in the future where they're more comfortable making those pre-qualification decisions. Now, when you have the case where, which I think is the majority of the cases, somebody in the technology area says, oh, I have all these suppliers. Sometimes, especially if they're coming from an IT background and not a cyber background, they also don't know some of those same practical things. Like, let's just judge the initial cyber posture before going into it, not just because we saw them at this conference and they sent us lots of emails. And that is something that I think that we're all sort of overwhelmed and tired of assessments, because if somebody fills out an assessment and you're not taking any action on it, I fill out assessments for years and I was shocked that they would never come back and ask additional questions. But, you know, what's the purpose? I probably could have said, you know, we hire pandas to do, you know, this, and we have crocodiles in the basement, and nobody would have read it. And I think that if you're going to take that next step of really evaluating your suppliers, work with the teams together to say, here's what you can do to pre-qualify from a supplier's, you know, here's the kinds of things. And then at the next layer, here's some of our criteria and our decision-making criteria for selecting the supplier. And what that means, and I mentioned that in the chapter on suppliers, is that means you should be adjusting your templates and your cyber templates to set certain, let's just say if they didn't meet the qualifications, you put it in the statement of work. You can ask for discounts. You know, we're concerned about your cyber posture, or, you know, we need this SLA. We need you to notify us. So it's not the sake of getting an assessment. It's to create that relationship. And I cover that quite a bit about how important it is. If your critical suppliers are not having cyber conversations with your cyber leader in cyber to cyber kind of leadership, then you've still got a gap. Because let's just say you're a startup or a medium-sized company and you don't have all the nice cool tools that are monitoring and checking all the threat intelligence and all the feeds going out there. And you're hoping that the supplier, or you'll see it in the news, that such and such had an event. You may notice it when the app stops working or something like that, you know, and it's just, who are you going to call? So that by having that and knowing your assets and your critical vendors, and that's part of the procurement. A lot of procurement teams, especially large organizations, they have these quarterly reviews, right? Quality checks or yearly reviews. And is cyber involved in them? I would say 99% are not. And yet, when, you know, for our critical suppliers, when we go to that conversation, we have, you know, the scoring system, you know, here's our concern about this. You've got an open, you know, footprint, or, you know, you've had these vulnerabilities and we had to react that. And sometimes that, you know, I can have those conversations because I know those suppliers, which is really important. And we, as a large supplier, do the same for our customers. If there's something out there and we hear it, we contact them. There was a customer out there that had an event in 2023, and we contacted them. And afterwards, they told us, you're the only supplier that contacted us to see how you could help, right? And that's all relationships that you've developed during that third-party process. And it's really important.
Yeah, I think it's no question super important all the way through. And I mentioned this on another episode that I've heard from some CISOs that they actually bring some of their key suppliers in as part of their IR tabletops.
That's right.
It's all good to have a policy, all good to have a score when it hits, if and when it hits, how are you going to respond together? So having that there is cool. Are there differences? I'm looking at this a couple different ways. One, from the way we look at risk, the way we run ops, the way procurement deals with IT versus OT. Because I know when we're talking cybersecurity, we have the IT stuff. We're not great at it, but we have it figured out. Right? Yeah. We kind of know what we need to do. We're not great at doing it. And my perspective is in OT, it's still kind of a wild west, and IT security is trying to help inform. That's my naive view of it. How close to reality is that? What do you see? Obviously, in the context of supply chain as well.
Sure. I actually don't see OT as much of a wild west. I would say a lot of products and that are container based or just anything that's, you know, quick development is more where they haven't addressed as much cybersecurity or scalability or things like that. From a management standpoint, an OT management, that has been definitely not considered, even though it has the word technology and operational technology, it hasn't been considered a technology. You know, it's to a lot of folks, it's no different than a hammer, right? This is something that's going to perform a function. We set it up. We want it to run working in critical infrastructure, even manufacturing environments. These are expected to be 24/7. Some places don't have patch windows at all. It's running. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's not like your car that you take in to get an oil change every 5,000 miles. And now, you know, where there's over-the-air firmware updates and patches that are happening to the vehicles, that's not the case for the operational technology. And so the IT folks, you know, it's very, I would say, let me just say it this way. There has to be an alignment and of the processes and the parameters by which they work together. And the reason that is in many, as I mentioned, OT environment safety is involved. So let's say you take a wastewater plant that has operational technology running, you know, the pumps and the filtering system and this and that. Now, OT, the majority of it is not intended to be internet facing. And when something is internet facing and it's found on Shodan, that's a problem. Now, if you have edge devices and things like that are meant to be that communication layer between those are going to have a different level of security. And that's more where you would see something in between. But what happens is, you know, the standard culture for IT security is if it's not patched, then it's completely vulnerable, and we've got to get this done, and we've got to fix it. And the concentration needs to be on the defense in depth, the compensating controls, and the mitigations that are in place. You know, threat modeling the entire environment and the landscape is extremely important because you're looking for those. It could be that changing out just one set of technology in the OT space could mean $1 million by the time you not only buy the equipment, but also all the engineering time it takes to change something out. Whereas you could secure, you know, the entire environment for, you know, $20,000 or something at that level, right? And enhance your monitoring tools. There's lots of tools out there now that are monitoring those OT environments for anything that may be out there. Because a lot of this OT product, we intend it to be decades, to live for decades, right? This is very, very different than an IT, you know, your phone you change out every 3 or 4 years that gets a patch every other day. This OT operational technology is has generally for us a 30-year PKI certificate, right? Because it needs to be in existence that long and running nonstop. So we don't see a lot of technologies that are out there today. So I think that what can help the best is have IT folks take some OT training to really understand that. Really understand. That's why I cover so much of it in the book, is explaining, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the complications for hardware, but that it is not intended to be accessible to the internet. And so integrations and things like that have to be done very carefully. On a small OT or even IoT device, you don't expect your printer, you know, your IoT printer to have a very detailed structure to handle massive scale DDoS attacks, right? It's not a Cloudflare. Well, these OT devices can't do it too. They've got a very small footprint, and they need to focus and work, you know, that they're processing technology. They have to run at certain speeds and be able to do what they need to do to be able to manage the environments, that physical environment that they're managing. And, you know, adding in layers and layers and layers, these, you know, there's not enough that you could do. I mean, try to imagine adding that to a Philips light bulb, right? A smart light bulb. You can't do all of that. So I see in, you know, a lot of, let's just say public government documents that are coming out, and they don't take OT into mind, and they're written for IT practitioners, and they're written by IT practitioners. You can't do MFA on a building sensor, right? Who is it going to call? You know, where's the code going to go when you have to reset it? So there's a lot we have to do to be able to bring that product, you know, where it can be added to those environments. And there's different kind of zero trust technologies that OT products are being looked toward. But it also has to talk to the one you've been had there for 15 years. And, you know, I've seen products where, you know, if they still require HTTP because the web servers have to talk to the other products in that same chain. And it's important for the IT groups to secure that communication chain and what's going across, you know, end to end. And they can do that without swapping out those full components.
Super enlightening. It's funny because when one of the questions, I spend most of my time looking at IT ops stuff and cyber in that world. OT is really fascinating, and I'd like to learn more, of course. But one of the questions I often ask is it possible for security to have a greater impact on how the business is built before it's actually built? So back in the definition and architecture phase, so that we're not patching security on later. When it's, and oftentimes I get yes, it can, or yes, not. But what I'm hearing now is you almost can't do that in OT. You have to prepare for the mitigating controls and the abstractions for security and the separations of networks and all this kind of stuff that not device specific type security or systems even specific type security stuff, which is really interesting.
Yeah. And that's one of the, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, everybody did admin, right? We didn't know any better. And now we do. But, you know, are you going to rip all of that out? Or are you going to defend it against anything like that? And we're going to see that over and over. Like, I mean, just the complexity of the attacks. It's different than something physical or something out of science where you can say, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. Cyber is an event that happens, you know, all these attacks, and they change and they get more sophisticated every day. And that's why, really, you know, keeping up and having understanding the entire landscape is really important, because unless you plan to swap out every single thing in your environment, I mean, if you've got, again, I'm going to mention it like a printer. So you're going to swap that out every 2 years because, you know, then it has to be able to defend against this and this and this. And, you know, it's different than like building a car tire, where you've got the science and the physics, where cyber, it just continuously grows. And one of the areas which is coming up a lot is memory safe languages. Well, you know, it's not proven that Rust can handle the processing speed that's, you know, certain, let's say, older languages can be able to do at that processing level. You've got to start somewhere, right? I mean, there's a chicken and egg here. There's always a level of instruction sets that are being created and used. And so we're going to see a lot of this where, you know, moving toward, you know, the latest and greatest. You can't do that and fully rip and replace everything every single time. And, you know, that's why we've seen software packages grow tremendously in size over the years. Now we need to work on that technical debt, but a lot of OT and, you know, environments, we remove as much as possible because, again, I said it was a small footprint. And back to software supply chain security in general, just if you've got an iPhone, for anybody out there, it comes pre-installed with 50 apps. You've got the operating system and 49 apps. You know, who's vetting those apps? Those are some of the questions that should be asked, not necessarily, you know, from an OT, you know, how do I, we used to have to add our own VPNs, and now it has, you know, things, you know, there's additional features built in, but you also can't use an iPhone that's 8 years old because it requires hardware at a certain performance speed to be able to work. And we need to consider that when working with all these devices. I'm sure everybody would wish that their iPhone could last 20 years. I was very sad when mine wouldn't even handle the latest version. You know, I was using an iPhone 7 until it stopped doing auto updates. So, you know, there's a lot that we need to consider. The EU Cyber Resilience Act is requiring manufacturers and software publishers to say, here's how long at a minimum we're going to commit to for this product. And it's requiring 3 to 5 years. And, you know, I'm sort of worried about buying cars that don't, you know, pieces of it don't operate in 15 years. You know, I could go buy a 69 Mustang and I know I can keep it running, but you know, what about that that car that requires on thousands of modules? You know, what's the lifespan of that?
Exactly. Or the cloud service provider that everything's orchestrated through.
Yes.
Ah, boy, 40 minutes. I have a gazillion questions left. I'm going to hold them. Maybe I'll entice you to come back on. We can take another dive on some of these other topics that are floating around in my head. Sure. I want to leave you with a final thought on the impact you hope this will have for folks that read it.
So the impact is, and this is where I'm just honored that so many people that I know are buying multiple copies and, you know, buying it for their organizations, buying it for the, you know, for the people they are in touch with, and also professors. I've got a long list now of people who want to use it in their classes because somebody hears like SolarWinds or this or that, that's just a piece of it, right? And whether you're a computer science student or anybody in technology or someone in business, I mean, this is a book for MBAs, right? There should be no reason why if somebody is going into business today, they have to understand the technology risks and their third party risks. So I'm just really thrilled and pleased and astounded by how many people are really taking this up and seriously. And it makes me think we should be doing this more. It's a business book in all senses. And I think the more that we could do this, I think the bigger the difference will be. And that way we'll democratize some of this this area that cyber books are only read by technical people.
Fantastic. One of the names, is this show's gone through many iterations. One of its names was the business of security. So I love that that it's a business book, and that it's for MBAs. I think we need to be teaching this stuff to the mm-hmm. business folks for certain. We put a lot of pressure on the CISO to be business minded. I think the business needs to be cyber as well. So. Absolutely. Congratulations on this, and hopefully loads of people pick it up and get tremendous value out of it, not just for their sake, but for our sake.
Yes.
Right? Yes. We're all relying on this stuff. So Cassie, the pleasure meeting you. I do hope you come back. I think more on OT and supply chain and, I don't know, EU cyber resilience. There's loads of stuff floating around in my head now.
Sure.
But until then, hope everybody enjoyed this episode. I'll put a link into the book, Software Supply Chain Security by Cassie Crosley. And please do subscribe and share. Connect with Cassie if you like. Say bad things about me in the comments. And we'll see everybody on the next one. Cassie, thank you.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com. Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Redefining Cybersecurity with Sean Martin, part of the ITSP Magazine podcast network. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share this show and ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to connect your brand with our conversations, you can sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.
Pentera, the leader in automation security validation, allows organizations to continuously test the integrity of all cybersecurity layers by emulating real-world attacks at scale to pinpoint the exploitable vulnerabilities and prioritize remediation towards business impact. Learn more at pentera.io.
Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Redefining Cybersecurity podcast with Sean Martin. Please take a moment to rate the show and leave a comment. And remember to share the Redefining Cybersecurity podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues. Come back for more conversations and follow Sean Martin as he continues his journey towards redefining cybersecurity.